Welcome to Radio Turnspeak from turnspeak.com. The views expressed by guests of Turnspeak do not necessarily represent those of Turnspeak Radio. Your host today is Jesse Wall.
Okay, so we're on the line today with Eustace Mullins, and we're going to ask him some questions regarding the occult, relating to the occult. Usually topics I've heard Eustace interviewed on are usually having to do more with politics and upfront issues like the Federal Reserve, stuff like that. But I thought we might be able to get into more hidden subjects having to do with actually with the Jesuits, possibly with the Freemasons and Zionists and all those subjects. So first off, I heard on an interview yesterday, Eustace, that you were mentioning that there was some sort of connection with the Jesuits having to do with them hiding information or something. Would you be able to elaborate just and tell me whatever you do know about Jesuit connections and conspiracies and et cetera?
Well, one of the most important discoveries I made some years ago was that all the conspiracies work together. These conspiracies are not all competing with each other or fighting each other. They work together. They share information. They have common agents who work for both of them. And that's why intelligence is so efficient in operation today, because it's very unified and it's very cooperative. Now, there was a myth during the Cold War with Russia that the KGB and the CIA were mortal enemies, and I found that that wasn't true. And as I researched further, I found that all of the intelligence agencies work very cooperatively together, share information, and so forth.
Now, what about the Vatican and Vatican II? So Vatican I and Vatican II was, you know, some conspiracy theorists or whatever will say that when Vatican II came about, it was because they'd replaced the real Pope with a Masonic Pope, essentially, and that the Pope John Paul I, I believe, he was killed after 33 days or something in office.
Oh, yes.
Or whatever. What do you know about that?
I've never really looked into that. It's been accepted as common fact. Books have been written about it, so I've never had occasion to investigate that myself, but it's the way they operate.
Yeah. Okay. And would you guess that the Jesuits had anything to do with that?
Well, what to include with that?
Yeah, what do you think that the Jesuits might have had anything to do with the deposing of John Paul I?
Oh, yes. You see, the Jesuit supremacy in the Vatican came about through the Central Intelligence Agency. There was a CIA agent operating in Italy after the fall of Mussolini. And, of course, he was very well found. It was called the OSS at that time. It wasn't yet CIA, Office of Strategic Survey. Mm-hmm. And OSS, this agent was working with the top people in the Vatican. And so he formed an organization called Propaganda II. Propaganda II. And this was inserted the communists and the Zionists into the upper levels of the Vatican with CIA funds, of which he had an ample supply. And that is when the Vatican was pretty well taken over by this Propaganda II operation. And there have been books about that, and so I have that in my book also.
Okay, so what would you say would be the difference between Jesuits and Zionists? They seem to be operating both behind the scenes, et cetera. Are they related? Are they separate?
No, they're not separate. They work together. The Zionists and the other intelligence agents work very satisfactorily together because it makes them much more efficient. See, there was this myth, which with the James Bond stories on in the movies and so forth, that the intelligence agencies were all great rivals and they murdered each other and so forth. And in fact, they always worked very well together. When I was in the Army in World War II, we had a G2 agent. It was called the intelligence agents in the Army. It was called G2 at that time. And there was a G2 agent in every barracks, just to observe and to report on any instances of unpatriotic behavior and that sort of thing.
Now, I'd like to ask you more of what about the safety of people who reveal information? For example, obviously, you've been doing this for a long time, and what is it that has kept you safe? Why have they not silenced you?
Oh, they've tried to silence me all the time. And right now, I'm in house arrest. I can't leave my home because they have taken my driver's license. And they did this through a propaganda operation at the University of Virginia, which is a very respected medical school here in Virginia. And so they gave me a test a few years ago. My brother took me over there, and it was a setup, and I didn't know it. And so he tested me by showing me Polaroid color photographs of African women. Mm-hmm. And then they shuffled around and asked me to pick out the ones I'd seen and the ones I had not seen. And, of course, it was totally impossible because they were all exactly alike. And so then this psychologist, she was a German Jewish woman named Dr. Fuchs. And so then she reported that I had had a total loss of memory because I couldn't identify these African women. And so she made a formal report that my memory was totally gone. And the Department of Motor Vehicles was notified of this, and they wouldn't let me drive anymore because they said my memory was so bad that I didn't know where I was and I could get lost and cause a terrible accident. And I've been walking for the last 5 years because of this.
Oh,
this
really?
Is the sort of thing they do.
And your brother unfortunately had something to do with this?
Oh, my two younger brothers, they were, I was making quite a lot of money out of my books at that time, and so they were anxious to get their hands on it.
Oh, really?
And so they set me up for this so they could control me.
Now, I read on the internet that in January of this year, you went missing. And I'd like to know more about that.
Oh, I was missing for a while because that was here in Virginia. You know, Virginia, the state of Virginia where I live, is still an occupied state from the Civil War of 1865.
Uh-huh.
And we have this occupation government the same as we have an occupation government in Germany and an occupation government in Japan. Because once these people take power, they'll never give it up. It's just like in Iraq. We'll be in Iraq for the next 300 years because the occupation governments will never relinquish their authority because it gives them such power. And so the state of Virginia has been completely a federal occupied territory since 1865. It has no state government of its own, and the eight southern states that were in the Civil War are all occupied territories, so they can do whatever you want to in those states.
Okay.
They have no rights whatsoever.
And now, obviously, you must have been around a lot of Freemasons, you know, during the past, whatever, 60 years or whatever. What have they ever asked you to join?
Oh, absolutely not. Well, the FBI tried to recruit me as an informant years ago when I was living in Chicago. And I was very hot at that time because I was very active and I was working with all the groups, all the patriotic people. And so they wanted to get rid of me. So the FBI chased me down the street one day and asked me to take a ride with them. And we drove around. And so this he was associate director of the FBI. And he kept asking me, does anyone in the FBI owe you any money? And I was totally nonplussed by this because nobody in the FBI ever lent me any money. So he asked me over and over again, has anyone in the FBI lent you any, owed you any money? And, of course, the answer would have been, yes, they owe me $5,000. Then he would have said, we'll give you the $5,000 and settle the debt, and then maybe you could help us with some of our work.
Oh, really?
That's how they recruit informants, you see.
But you turned them down, though?
I turned them down because I had no idea what they were up to.
Yeah.
I was still very naive at that time. This was about 50 years ago.
Now, what about Masons? They've never approached you to join them? Or?
Nature?
The
Nature.
Freemasons, yeah.
Oh, no, they've never asked me. Because you see, they have no leverage on you. They won't work with you unless they have leverage. See, if I'd accepted this supposed repayment of money from the FBI, then they would have recruited me. I've been recruited. I've become an agent for them. But since I didn't know what was going on, I didn't accept the offer.
Right, okay. Now, do you know anyone who has actually been, it's a heavy question, but do you know anyone who has actually been killed because of what they knew?
Well, the Anti-Defamation League with B'nai B'rith was going after a lot of the patriots back in the 50s, and they were actually some of them were actually murdered in Chicago, and there were attempts to assassinate me, and I had to leave Chicago and come back to Virginia.
Really, how did what were the attempts? What how did they try to do that?
Well, there was a gunman who chased me all over Chicago one evening. I was just out roaming around, and so I realized this guy was after me because I was working for a corporation in Chicago, which was a very big corporation. It's called the Chicago Motor Club, and one of my secretaries there was dating a boy in the mafia and was going to marry him, and so to help her out, they were giving her tips on horses, and of course they always came in, and so as a favor to me because I was her employer, she was giving me tips on horses, and I was winning on horses all the time. But the bookie got upset about it, and so he reported that I had not paid my bill. So they sent a guy out to get me.
Really? Now, okay, so I would also like to know, what do you think is the actual goal of Zionism? Beyond political, beyond financial, what are they seeking to establish? Is it the establishment of a temple in Israel, in Jerusalem?
Well, a temple is only symbolic. They want world power, and they want the temple as a symbol of that world power. That's what they're building for, and that's what the wiping out the Palestinian people in the recent invasion of Beirut and Lebanon, which they had done before several times, was a step in the road to that achievement. And
Okay.
they're quite merciless. They kill mostly women and children in this operation because Premier Shamir has openly boasted that their only goal in Israel is to exterminate the Arab peoples of the Middle East. And not only will they get their oil, but they also will have unchallenged power there.
Now, what about the powers at the top? Are they religious? Are they one denomination or another, or are they just power mongers? What would their ideology be?
Well, their ideology is kind of is fluid, and they'll go with any ideology if it helps them gain their ends. I mean, they could be communists or Nazis or fascists or whatever you want, or Zionists. And in fact, quite a few of them are all four. The state government of Virginia is, I've denounced it as a communist, Zionist, fascist conspiracy
And so
because
they
it
could
works for all.
theoretically, oh yeah, go ahead.
Pardon?
They could theoretically be Jewish, they could be Catholic, they could even be Islamic or anything else. Is that the
Oh yes,
case?
they're not exclusive whatsoever. They don't exclude anything because these people are after total power, and in that goal, they'll serve any master as long as
Right,
that
right.
is.
So then what is the purpose of anti-Semitism? Is it a red herring? Is it an
Oh, it's
escape
always
mechanism?
anti-Semitism has always been created by the Zionists because that's the key to the whole operation. Just like the Holocaust propaganda is the State of Israel would not have existed since 1948 without the Holocaust because that brings them continued support and more adherence and it furthers all of their political goals.
So
So they'll never give up.
European Freemasons would not necessarily be any different ideologically than Middle Eastern Zionists, because they would seem to have the same goal. Is that what you think?
Oh yes, certainly that. I think the European nations are quite alive to this situation, and they're fed up with it because the occupied state of Germany right now is almost covered with Holocaust memorials, and they keep building more. And this is quite agonizing to the German people, because World War II ended in 1945, and so did any persecution of the Jewish people. But they're getting their noses rubbed in 24 hours a day, and they're tired of it. My friend Ernst Zundel, who is an old German patriot, is still on trial today in Mannheim, Germany, for supposedly being a Holocaust denier, although he's never denied the Holocaust. He's tried to explain it. I'm called a Holocaust denier myself, but I'm actually a Holocaust explainer. I gave a lecture in Washington recently in which I explained about the Holocaust. We had a panel on the Holocaust, and I said, you have to understand that the Holocaust is part of the Federal Reserve System, part of the Rothschild Central Bank. And that is why the Bureau of Printing and Gary in Washington, D.C., prints all the currency of the United States, and it's in the building next to the Holocaust Museum. So that proximity is not accidental. It's to show people what is actually going on.
Now, you mentioned something about the Rothschilds having to do with the Templars' treasure. I've often suspected that the Rothschilds, the name Rothschild may be a kind of just general reference almost to the Templars themselves, because it's, you know, it's a red shield. Sorry?
Oh, yeah. It's actually it's not really a name, it's a signal. The Rothschild, the red shield is the is the world signal of world Zionism. And the state of Israel today was totally created by the Rothschild Bank itself. No, they had no monetary support from anyone else. The Rothschilds poured all their money into the state of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And almost everything in Israel is named after the Rothschilds. You have Rothschild Boulevard, Rothschild Museum, and the entire Knesset, the Israeli parliament, is a beautiful building. It was entirely donated by Jacob Rothschild of London.
Oh, really? You've been to Jerusalem?
No, I haven't. I think it'd be a little dangerous for me to go there.
Would it?
Well, I'm sure it would, because I'm considered their number one opposition all over the world.
I was looking. Go ahead.
See, my books have been circulating for the last 50 years. They've reached a lot of people, and nothing has ever been challenged in them, because they were all documented at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., from official U.S. government reports. So they haven't been able to deal with me at all, and so obviously I don't do much traveling around in the Middle East.
Yeah. Well, have you been to Venice? I was reading about Ezra Pound, how he's buried in, I think it's called San Michele, which is an island cemetery in Venice.
Oh, yes, he was buried in Venice because that's where he passed away. You see, I got him freed from imprisonment in Washington, D.C. by the federal government in 1958. And so he returned to Venice, where his mistress had a house there, and he lived there until he passed away. And let's see, he was 87 when he died. So that was 1985 he died.
72, yeah, that's what I thought I saw. Now, can you, for listeners who are not familiar with Ezra Pound, and I'm one of them actually, I've looked him up a little bit, but I don't know much about him. Can you give like a brief bio of what he was all about? Apparently he had something to do with modernity, and he was like a key player in the British modernist movement in the teens.
Well, he was very close to Major C.H. Douglas, who started the social credit movement, which was intended to be a sound movement, sound money movement. And they actually did have a social credit government in the province of Alberta in Canada. But that's the only place that's ever been adopted. And Ezra propagandized for the social credit movement in all of his writings. But he was primarily a poet. And he also was a great teacher. You see, he commissioned my book on the Federal Reserve System. He asked me to go to the Library of Congress in 1948 and see what I could find out about the Federal Reserve System. And I got the total history of it, and we published that in 1953. And it's been in print ever since. It's gone through many editions. But Ezra Pound was solely responsible for that book because I had never heard of the Federal Reserve System when he sent me to the Library of Congress to look up about it. And so it was a delight to him to find everything he ever said about the international banking situation was documented by my research.
Okay, on the Wikipedia article about Ezra Pound, it says that apparently Allen Ginsberg was quoted in an interview stating that Ezra Pound regretted that his work was tainted with, quote, that stupid suburban prejudice of anti-Semitism.
I knew Allen Ginsberg for years. He was a total phony. I don't believe that Ezra ever said any such thing. You see, Allen Ginsberg was a homosexual drug addict and New York City.
Yeah.
And he went over to visit Pound in Venice. And Pound was very friendly to him and talked very frankly to him. And but I don't think that he ever said one word of that so stupid suburban prejudice. It's totally unlike Ezra to say something like that.
Really?
And I used to visit him 3 hours a day and listen to him talk for 3 hours at a time. I never heard him say anything like that during the years that I knew him.
Yeah, now that you mention it, it sounds like something Allen Ginsberg would actually say. It sounds like a Ginsbergism.
Oh, yeah. Allen Ginsberg invented that out of whole cloth because Ginsberg was a totally degenerate person.
Yeah, and, we can tell. Yeah.
And I even spent a night in his apartment. Ezra sent me to Washington to visit a friend of his, and this friend had to stay in their apartment, and this friend was the roommate of Allen Ginsberg. And of course, I had never heard of him at that time. I paid a little attention to him because this friend was a very good person and a good friend of Ezra Pound. And just a year or two later, he became a very notorious person. And
so,
I was shocked to think that I had spent a night in the same room with such a man.
Yeah. So what was Ginsberg's relation to Ezra Pound? Were they friends or just acquaintances?
Oh, God. Well, Ezra was not a prejudiced person. He met many Jewish people while he was in St. Elizabeth's. And in fact, some of the Jews were afraid to go see him because they couldn't face him. And say what they would ask me to accompany them to St. Elizabeth so that Ezra would speak to them, although he always spoke to them anyway. But he was not prejudiced against anyone, and he treated everyone equally.
Now,
many Jewish people, even Stephen Spender, the English poet, he came to see Ezra while I was there, and Ezra was quite friendly to him because they have many, many mutual friends, and he had quite a good time. Stephen Spender later wrote an extensive version of their conversation in one of his books, and he was quite respectful of them.
Oh, really? Now, Did you happen to, on a side note, did you happen to know anything about what happened to John Lennon, why they killed him?
Oh, I never knew anything about that. That was a total mystery to me.
Really?
It's very possible there was some intelligence, British Secret Service in that, because the British Secret Service is in everything.
Yeah.
And they may have had some reason for doing that, because the Beatles were very prominent in they were not prominent in British political life, but they were an important factor of modern Britain. And there may have been something going on there. I just was never able to trace it down.
Yeah. Now I'll ask your opinion. What do you think of this new movement on the internet, the truth movement? And are there any participants in it that you know for a fact are not legitimate?
No, I haven't even heard of that movement, frankly. I'm not very active on the internet because I'm primarily a historian and a scholar, and I don't. My name appears on the internet quite a lot. They always pick up something, but I have never had any real contact with them.
Okay.
And I don't have any idea who the principals in the truth movement are. But there's a lot going on the internet because the internet is wide open. You can get anything on it. And I even put the story about my flight to Ohio last January because they were really setting me up here and I had to get out of the state.
Yeah, can you tell me more about that? What did it say? We mentioned this earlier. What did it say? The article was about you're going to Ohio, but it seemed to make it out that you had been kidnapped or you were missing or something.
Oh, there was no kidnapping. I vanished voluntarily. I fled for my life is what it was. And some friends hit me out up on the border of Ohio and Michigan. And nobody could find me there. Nobody knew where I was. Mm-hmm. And it was a good hiatus for me because it enabled me to recollect myself and to get back to work.
Okay.
In fact, I fled up twice. I fled in January and I fled again in May. I came back here. It was just as bad as ever. So I went back up to Ohio for a couple more months.
Now, I don't know if you've happened to catch this on the news, but it seems like the topic of 9/11 has finally reached the mainstream. And there's a cartoon called South Park, which did an entire episode on 9/11 conspiracy theories.
Oh, yes.
What do you
think? Well, 9/11.
Yeah.
And 9/11 became so obvious that it was no longer a conspiracy. Everybody knew about it. I have friends in New York City, and they say there are mass demonstrations and processions every day protesting 9/11 right in New York City because it happened right there. And the people were there, and they saw it all. And it's the headquarters of communications for the entire nation. All your television, all your radio goes right out of New York City. So too many people were present at that time and saw exactly what was going on. And they did so many amateur movies of the towers collapsing, and it was a classical demolition collapse because everything came down just the way it would with the controlled demolition. And there was nothing happened on 9/11 could possibly have been caused by a plane hitting a building.
Yeah.
So that's generally conceded now. And me, I don't even look into 9/11 anymore because the whole thing has been so obvious. There's nothing conspiratorial about it. It's out there for everyone to see.
Yeah, it's all cut and dry. It's just whether people refuse to accept the truth or whether they accept it.
Well, that's the people who will not accept any truth about anything. They're constitutionally crippled and they're not able to perceive a fact when it's shown them.
Yeah, yeah. Now, when you say constitutionally crippled, do you mean they're in their own person or because the Constitution has been rendered null and void as of recently?
They've rendered the competition null and void. You see, when I became active in this movement back in the 40s and 50s, there were hundreds of patriotic groups throughout the United States, principally in New York City, Chicago, and Florida and California. And so I worked with all of them and was very close to them. They all published my work and promoted my work because they could see that the stuff that I brought in was reliable. See, all of these groups were constantly being flooded with disinformation, which was designed to completely discredit them. And when I came along and was giving them factual revelations from official government documents at the Library of Congress in Washington, and no one could ever contradict them. So they all became very reliant on me to provide them with good information. So I had an entree to all of them. I worked with all of them. They were very good people.
And you said that Ezra Pound left basically a library of information that he had gathered, his writings, etc., to you. Now, how are you planning on passing that on? Are you going to have that transcribed, put on the internet?
Well, actually, about 75% of it has already been printed in my various books.
Oh, good. Okay.
And the rest of it is very well disposed of. because, you see, Ezra spent 30 years after, in 1920, he was living in London. He married Dorothy Shakespeare, and who stayed his wife. She was his wife for the rest of his life. And so Ezra was so disturbed by the fact that World War I had been so catastrophic because so many young writers and artists whom he knew had been killed in this war. And he started asking questions, just what caused this war? And in fact, a professor recently reported that his history class, that he asked the question, what were the causes of World War I? And one of his students replied, you mean there was more than one? Because they haven't a clue as to what World War I was actually about. It was actually about a commercial competition between Germany and England, because the English quality couldn't compete with the German competition. The Germans were perfectionists. They were doing wonderful machine tools and automobiles and everything. And the British simply, they had a largely obsolete manufacturing system, and they simply were not able to compete. And so World War I and World War II occasioned solely by commercial competition between Germany and England.
Kind of like the end, kind of like the end of the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, you see, England was first in the Industrial Revolution and got the head start because the Industrial Revolution really started in England. But then the Germans began to come up around the turn of the century, and they had all new machines, and they really threw themselves into it, and they were dedicated to extremely high quality. And so it became very difficult for England to compete with them with its outmoded machinery. And in fact, Hitler helped England a lot during World War II by bombing many of its old factories and his old industrial working class neighborhoods for that reason. And it really improved things for them a lot.
Yeah, maybe with the exception of Birmingham.
Oh, Birmingham.
Yeah.
I don't know that. Yeah. I don't know Birmingham. Yeah, I really only know London. But I'm planning to come back to England soon. I was over there in 1994 for a UFO conference, a World UFO conference at Wembley Stadium, and I haven't been back to England since. I want to get over there.
So when Eisenhower said it was the military-industrial complex responsible for the wars and et cetera, he was actually telling the truth. I mean, that really is what it boils down to. It may not be anything having really directly to do with any given religion or even any given ideology. It really just is about power and industry.
Well, industry itself has to find an outlet for its products, and war is the best outlet that they've ever had. So they'll never give up war for that reason.
Mm-hmm. Now, what you mentioned a UFO conference. What is your take on the whole UFO situation? Let me tell you first what mine is. I think that there's always the possibility that there's life on other planets, all that kind of stuff, you know. But when it comes down to it, I think it's more or less usually unprovable, and it's often used as a red herring, as you know, to lure people away from the real conspiracies. What's your take on that?
Well, I don't think there's any conspiracy to it, because if you have life forms on other planets, then they're there. It doesn't take any conspiracy to conceive something that already exists. So, and in fact, I think communication between the planets has been on a very limited orbit so far. But that will probably improve in future years.
Mm-hmm. And what about, now that we're on that topic, what about the moon landing?
About what?
Was the moon landing real?
Oh, the moon landing. Well, that was exposed years ago because all the shadows in the filming were pointed the wrong way.
Yeah. So what do you think about all that? Were you blown away to find out that it was fake, or did you just figure
it? Well,
I think it was an
industrial production, an industrial operation. I don't think it had anything to do with landing on the moon at all.
And, yeah.
It was show business is all it was.
Yeah. Now, have you met David Icke?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I've lectured with David Icke for years.
Have you?
In fact, David and I were in Canada a couple of years ago, and so they tried to deport both of us, and David was very upset. He said it was because I was more controversial than he was, and that they were actually after me, but he was going to be deported too, and I haven't seen David since then.
Oh, really? 'Cause he is he is he I mean, I'm not intending to insult you at all, but is he afraid to be associated with you because you are more controversial?
Well, I think so, and David is more interested in expanding his operations and so forth, so he feels that it would be a definite limitation at that time.
Yeah. No,
Because there's no question that's been very controversial.
personally, I enjoy watching David Icke. He's
Oh,
entertaining,
yes, he's very good.
but
He's
I
very good.
think, but you know, sometimes I think, I wonder if he's like, you know, if he's working for the government or whatever. What do you think? Do you think he's working for the government?
Oh, I really don't know. I would say he probably has a connection with the British Secret Service, if he has anything. I don't think he has any connection with any American operation, because the American operations are very amateurish. You know, the whole Central Intelligence Agency was created by the British General Staff in 1944. And Charles Hambro, the Jewish banker, and Lord Mountbatten, and three other members of the Imperial General Staff created the OSS, which was later became the CIA. So we actually have never had our own intelligence operation. It's just a branch of the British Secret Service.
Oh, really? So the British Secret Service would have more sophisticated ways of dealing with culture creation, culture manipulation that would be in the realm of art, so to speak, so that David Icke, you know, doing what he does, talking the way he
Oh,
does,
yeah.
which is
Oh,
which
yeah, you can
yeah.
get a lot of people to work for you with an operation like that. The thing is that the British Secret Service is the premier intelligence agency of the world, because it was created after the Bank of England was created in 1694. Well, they set up British Secret Service as the intelligence agency of the Bank of England shortly after that. So it's hundreds of years older than any other intelligence service in the world.
Okay, so all respect due to David Icke, let's say hypothetically he were working for the British Secret Service. What would be his role and you know, his purpose?
Well, his role would be that of an advisor and a consultant rather than carrying out actual operations. Because what they're looking for is consultants who can help them plan operations and that sort of thing. In other words, he wouldn't be a James Bond floating around the world shooting at other agents and so forth.
But in his role as a propagandist, what how do you think that is his role? I mean, that's what I'm
Oh,
trying to get at.
I would know that that was his role or not. But he's done some rather odd things, like he put out all these stories about shape-shifting, about Queen Elizabeth and the British royal family shape-shifting and so forth. And I think there has been some of that in the family. The family has some legends about that, and it probably has happened in the past. So it's just something that you have to deal with.
Oh, really? So you believe that there is a possibility that there is shape shifting in the royal family and that it might be real?
Oh, yes.
Really?
Well, you know, Ezra Pound told me once that he was staying on a Riviera back in the 1930s, and he was going from his room downstairs, and this it was sort of dark in the halls there. It was a hotel in France. And he said someone bounded past him on all fours, and he continued down the hall and staying on all fours. And so he said, "What in the heck was that?" They said, "Oh, that's just Eddie."
Oh my God. That's
Because,
just, what did they say? That's just Eddie?
pardon?
What did they say?
Oh, the Duke of Windsor was known to run up and down the halls at night on all fours. He liked to bound on all fours.
You're
And,
kidding.
oh no.
Who,
Oh, this
is
was.
that Prince Philip? Sorry, pardon my lack of knowledge about the royal family. Is that Prince Philip?
No, this was Duke of Windsor.
Duke of Windsor. Okay, I'm not sure who that is.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's great.
So apparently that was well known among the inhabitants of the Riviera at that time, because he was there quite a lot. And so they took it as a matter of course. It wasn't anything extraordinary. But you have little eccentricities like that among all the royal families of Europe. George Sylvester Viereck was the illegitimate grandson of Kaiser Wilhelm I, and he was quite a peculiar character himself. I used to accuse Viereck of causing Germany to lose both World War I and World War II, and he was really rather flattered when I told him that, because he had never thought of it before. I think it's a good case to be made for it.
Now, have you yourself ever had any sort of occult experience or seen an occult ritual or heard of anything?
No, I have not. Because, you see, I'm a very faithful servant of Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ says in Matthew 27, he says, I am always with you. And if Christ is always with you, you're protected against a lot of things like that. So my occult experiences have been very limited.
Oh, really? What have you had? Have you had any or heard of anything firsthand?
Well, no. My mother and my sister, I took care of them until they passed away, and I'm still living in the same house they were in, because they were very well cared for. They died very peacefully, so they still occupy the house, but I have no problem with them whatsoever.
Oh, really? Do you feel them, or do you see them, or no?
No, I never see them myself, but other people have come in, and they tell me my mother's standing up at the hall landing on the upstairs.
Really?
Oh, yes. So other people have seen her, but I've never seen her myself, because I have her portrait, which was done when she's 19 years old, and I occasionally consult with that portrait, but I don't see her around the house at all.
But obviously she's a benevolent presence, not a bad presence.
Oh, it's a benevolent presence. There's no doubt it's a benevolent presence, because she had a very happy life here.
Well, that's nice. And you're in Virginia, are you?
You're in Virginia.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of the old houses in Virginia have ghosts, but that's because there was tragedies there. There were poisonings and murders and things like that. And when those things happen, people tend to hang around for a while.
Yeah.
But nothing like that ever happened here, and so it's very quite peaceful.
So that's why you live in close proximity to Washington, D.C., do you?
I live close to Washington. That's why I practically grew up on Capitol Hill in Washington in the late 40s.
I see. Okay. So you were definitely around all kinds of different people that were the movers and shakers.
Oh, yes. One of my closest friends was George Stimson, who was considered the most important journalist in Washington. He was the founder of the National Press Club, which, of course, is the home quarters of most of the journalists and lobbyists in Washington. And I used to have tea with E. Cummings in the afternoon in New York, and then drive back for. To have a late luncheon with George Simpson at the press club. And then I would go over to see Ezra Pound at St. Elizabeth's. And then when I was in New York, I'd go and have dinner with George Sylvester Viereck at the Hotel Royal on Upper Broadway. So I got around to all these people, and I was a constant. I used to have a tea with Cummings every day when I was in New York.
Now, if you don't mind my asking, what did you do in the 50s and 60s, and then 70s, also for employment or job, or you were selling books by what, the 70s?
Oh yes, I published and distributed all of my own books. I've never had a publisher or an agent in my life, and it made it a little difficult later on when I ran out of my principal books. I haven't been able to reprint them. The Curse of Canaan is the one that people call me up every day and don't want a copy. I understand some of my books out of print are being offered at $1,000 a copy on the internet.
Really?
Oh, yes.
And so you were able to support yourself from your publishing?
Oh, yes. I had a good income from my publishing. I was able to travel and carry on. I never had enough money to have an office and a secretary, unfortunately, because that would have helped enormously. because you do need assistance as you go along the way.
Yeah. But
and Ezra never had an office or a secretary himself.
Oh, really?
And, four of his proteges were awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Really?
T.S. Eliot. Oh, yes. T.S. Eliot, Ernest Hemingway, and William Butler Yeats, and James Joyce. They were all proteges of a Pound, and I'm his last living protege. I'm the last one that's left.
So do you consider him – what made him special? I saw a picture of him, and there is something about him that maybe would infer that he's really intelligent or something. I couldn't put my finger on it. But what is it about Ezra Pound that is so important? Is he a genius, or does he have some sort of spiritual understanding that other people don't have?
He was a genius, and he was also a teacher. He never I was not really a writer. I was a student when I met him. But yet he commissioned this book for on the Federal Reserve. It's the only book he ever commissioned in his life directly. And, of course, he guided me all the way through it, the research and everything. I used to do my research at the Library of Congress, and I would take that day's research over to him at the St. Elizabeth's. He would go over it. And, of course, he was perfectly familiar with all this work, and so there was never any problems with him interpreting it or anything like that. But he was so direct. Ezra never wasted a word, and he was so direct he could communicate with anyone. All sorts of people came to see him at St. Elizabeth's, so 3,800 people. And I was the only one that ever did anything of all the people that visited him, because they were more or less dilettantes. He complained that they came really to visit the zoo. That's the only reason they came. And it sort of annoyed him, because he was only interested in getting work done. That was his goal.
Well, was he American?
Oh, yes. He was an old American family.
Okay.
His family, Weston Pound, were very early settlers in this country.
Oh, really?
And his father was a director of the U.S. Mint in Philadelphia. So that was why he was so interested in money.
Interesting. And that's how he began to find out about the Federal Reserve being what it was.
Oh, yes, because when you find out what money is like, he used to tell me about seeing the men stripped to the waist in the Mint and shoveling gold dollars and silver dollars into big baskets and so forth. And it was really quite mundane.
Yeah. So, Mr. Mullins, has anyone ever accused you – don't take offense at my question, but has anyone ever accused you of being a government agent?
Oh, yes, indeed. In fact, I got notorious for that a few years ago, because I was never arrested and never tried for anything. And so people began to ask questions about this. They said, well, why isn't Eustace Mullins ever been tried for something? And they decided that I must be a government agent. But the fact is that the reason I was never tried for anything is because I was constantly suing the government agencies themselves. I sued the FBI, and I got the $85 million judgment, default judgment against the FBI. And I sued the U.S. Tax Court, and I got a letter from them that I had no tax liability. So these are the two most feared agencies in the United States, the Bureau of Internal Revenue and the FBI, and yet I sued them both and won in court against both of them.
Really?
That explains why I was never arrested.
Yeah, yeah. And you won a large amount of – you won millions of dollars, Eustace?
Oh, yes.
Really? So then you were able to fund further projects and also to fund yourself higher lawyers.
Well, I never was able to collect all of that money, but I managed to always keep going, and so I still have the problem of collecting the rest of it.
Yeah.
But for years, the tax agencies wouldn't bother me at all, because I'd been my case was heard by the head judge of the U.S. Court, Judge Tannenwald. And he ruled in my favor and said I had no liability whatsoever.
So you credit your still being alive and your safety to your fighting back against them.
Oh, yes. I never... The only time I ever ran was this year, because things got so tough in the year. I just had to get out of the state. But that was a state agency. You had an occupation government in the state of Virginia since 1865, and I became a primary target of them, because I define them as the Virginia Israel Commission in Richmond, Virginia. And that was what was running the whole state. It was not the state government. It was the Virginia Israel Commission.
Mm-hmm. Now, have
so
you...
They didn't like exposing. They didn't want that to be exposed.
Yeah.
And that's why they were causing me so much trouble.
But they've never attacked you physically.
No, they haven't. But they attacked my father, and my father died from the attack on him. Two army
counterintelligence.
Oh yes. Well, he had already had some heart trouble before, and so they attacked him. And what they wanted was to tell him who was furnishing my money, because they knew his circumstances were modest, and he wasn't furnishing my money, and they couldn't understand who was paying for all this research that I was doing and my upkeep doing that. And so they went right to him and demanded he tell them. And so he told them that he was not giving me any money because he had no money to give me. But they were very persistent. You know, these are government agents. And he finally lost his temper with them and said, look, if you'll tell me what my son has done, I'll cooperate with you anyway, whatever. I'll cooperate with you if he's committed any wrongdoing at all. But until you tell me what he's done, I won't tell you anything else. And so they started fighting, and they really gave him quite a beating, and he came down with a fatal coronary attack a short time later.
Oh, no. When was that, in the 70s?
Pardon?
Was that in the 70s? Was that in the 1970s?
Oh, yeah. That is recounted in my book, and Writ for Martyrs.
Okay.
And Writ for Martyrs is my book, which deals with crimes committed by federal agents against American citizens. You see, under our Constitution, no federal agent has a right to even talk to any citizen of a state, because actually a federal agent can only come into a state during a period of a rebellion. And no federal agent or federal judge is supposed to sit in any state in the United States. And I have that in my book, The Great Betrayal, that no federal agent can actually ask a question directly of any citizen. He has to approach the citizen through a state agent in order to ask him a question. But of course, the FBI and all these other government agencies have simply bypassed that with the welfare government in Washington. And so people don't have that protection. But you see, the United States was set up as a union of states. And the only business of the government is the welfare of the states, not the welfare of individual citizens. Individual citizens, their welfare is to be handled by state agencies.
Mm-hmm.
But the federal government has nothing to do with any individual citizen in this country.
Well, now the federal government's going to be rendered null because of the new American Union that they're proposing.
Oh yes.
So that they're not.
Oh
even,
yes, well, we're finally getting over. You see, Thomas Jefferson set up the Constitution as a protection of the people against the federal government, and you see. Don't forget, this was written in an atmosphere of revolution. We had just revolted against the British Empire. And so the founding fathers of this country wanted to protect the citizens against ever being oppressed by any government again. And that's what the Constitution is. It's a set of rules and regulations that the government has to follow in dealing with individual citizens. And they have violated all of those things many years ago.
Yeah.
That part of it. They can commit atrocities like keeping these so-called soldiers in Guantanamo Bay for years without trial or without any consultation of an attorney and without any observance of the Geneva Convention at all. And so this is a great outrage, and it's really affected the way the rest of the world views the United States, because they see us now as an outlaw nation. And really, that's what we've become.
Yeah, it is. Now, do you have any trouble traveling to Germany or other European countries where the Holocaust, you know, is enforced?
Oh, I would be arrested immediately if I set foot in Germany, because they've officially proclaimed years ago that I'm a Holocaust denier, which is absolutely false. But I'm considered on the blacklist there. I wouldn't dare to go to Germany. I don't even have a passport or a driver's license at the present time due to government harassment. So I'm pretty much housebound. I would like very much to have been speaking in Japan for years.
Have you?
Oh, yes. I have a very loyal following in Japan, because the Japanese people essentially believe in the same things that the American citizens believe in. And I was completely at home in Washington, Japan, and I went to the tomb of Ernest Fenollosa, who was a British citizen, but he was a protege of Ezra Pound. And he went to Japan and was so fascinated by life there that he became a Buddhist monk, and he's buried in Japan. I visited his tomb in Japan, and Ezra himself never got to Japan, because instead of going to Japan, he was in prison in St. Elizabeth's Hospital at that trial for 13 and a half years. It's the only instance in the United States history where anyone has been in prison at that trial for that period of time.
And what was the charge or whatever?
Well, the charge against him was treason, and it was drawn up by Alfred
Really?
Wilson, his personal assistant to the President of the United States. And when Ezra Pound was broadcasting to the American people to stay out of World War II, Alger Hiss went to the President and said, "We've got to indict him for giving aid and comfort to the enemy."
Wow. And who was the enemy that he was supposedly giving aid and comfort to?
Well, supposedly the government of Italy. He had no connection with the government of Italy whatsoever. He was simply living there as an American citizen. And he never gave any aid and comfort to the Italian government. And because there was no evidence of such, they finally dropped all the charges against him. I got a congressman to drop the charges against him in 1958, and he went back to Italy a free man. He was
Wow.
never convicted of anything.
How did you do that? By acting on his behalf as his attorney?
Oh, no. He had an attorney who never did anything for him whatsoever. Mm-hmm. His attorney stayed in New York, and I never even met his attorney during the years that I was visiting him.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't even exist. He did nothing for him. But I took a friend of mine to visit him whose congressman owed him a favor, because he had managed to elect this congressman to his father, had managed to elect this congressman to Congress from North Dakota. And so he went to him and said, "What can you do about Ezra Pound?" So he got on the floor of Congress and asked the question, an open question, why is the government holding this man? Because they had no evidence to hold him whatsoever. And the government promptly dropped all the charges. And
Wow.
after 13 minutes, but there was no apology for keeping him in illegal imprisonment for 13 and a half years, and no compensation. He just went back to Italy, said to hell with it all.
Amazing. So,
but I objected to that, because I said we needed Ezra Pound here, because he was the most valuable person in the world, and this he could have been enormous service to this country. But he went on back to Italy because he wanted some peace and quiet. He was then in his 70s, and he had been through the mill. He didn't want any more of it.
Yeah.
But I've always regretted that, because Ezra could have been a great help to this country.
Yeah, you're still very active, and you're in your 80s, are you not?
Oh, yes. I have never taken a vacation. I work 7 days a week, because really there's so much to do with it.
Yeah.
But in fact, that's all that's keeping me alive, because when you have so much to do, you're not going to fall over that quick.
Now, I have a question about an ideological question. Now, when it comes down to it, why are the powers that be wrong for what they're doing? Are they wrong for what they're doing?
Well, they're powers of darkness. Christ warned people about the powers of darkness. And, you know, the conspiracy against him was accomplished at night. And that's when he was convicted. And this is when the evil spirits come out at night. See, we have Halloween coming up here next week, which is one of the great American holidays. And everybody in this country revels in witches and costumes and so forth.
So you really think it's you really think it's about a real power of a battle of good against evil?
Oh yes, that's really? It's going on. It's going on all the time right here on this earth. And you know, you have to take a stand and join one side or the other.
And are these people at the top? Are they witches, warlocks, sorcerers, cabalists?
Well, they're sorcerers and they're pedophiliacs and drug addicts and everything else. I mean, you name it, they've got it. But that's their life. It's the life that they live, and it's a life of unhappiness and disappointment because they can achieve nothing on this earth because they're working for the powers of darkness.
Can you name a time in history when they were not in power?
Well, I think the powers of darkness have waned and prospered all through history. They have their good years and their bad years. And right now the powers of darkness are pretty much in total control.
Yeah.
Because so much of modern technology has been converted by the powers of darkness, television and computers and so forth. But at the same time, computers and the Internet are doing a tremendous job for freedom. Because the Internet welcomes revelations of any sort. And this country is entirely changing through the Internet. I get more mentioned on the Internet than anybody because
yeah.
I'm active in so many ways. And I never sought any of this. I never purposely went out to get on the Internet or anything else. But it's just that so many people on the Internet realize what I'm doing and the influence that I'm having, and so they publicize what I do.
Now, pedophilia is obviously the subject of the day. Now, it would seem that it is somewhat exaggerated simply because it is basically the last taboo. Everything else has been, all the other taboos have been destroyed. It would seem, you know, viewing the footage that Alex Jones got at Bohemian Grove, that these people in powerful positions are very much exposed to at least mock representations of child sacrifice. But do you think how widespread do you think it actually is?
Well, FBI figures are that 600,000 children disappear in the United States every year. No one knows what happens to them.
You're kidding.
Oh, yeah, 600,000. Yeah, well, this is a big country, you know.
Oh, but that's still.
We just passed 300 million. But children can disappear so easily. Their parents move somewhere else to another state and so forth. So it's very easy to lose track of them. But I knew of one notorious case when I lived in Chicago, the ritual murder of three young German boys in Chicago. And in fact, I contacted Arnold East in England about that, and we sent him all the information on it. And when he got that information, which involved the highest officials in Chicago, Arnold East died suddenly. That was when Arnold East died. He was the world authority on ritual murder.
Really?
He died because of that one case.
Did Ezra Pound or anybody you've known ever mention anything about George Orwell and how he died like right after 1984 was published?
No, I don't think Pound ever mentioned George Orwell, but some of my friends have been tremendously influenced by Orwell in 1984. I remember when 1984 came along and nothing happened at all.
Yeah.
That was to be a key year. It turned out to be a very quiet time.
Yeah, I was only
I think Orwell had a powerful vision.
Orwell, yeah.
Yeah, of course, Orwell himself was a socialist, and I'm not sure that he fought in the Spanish Civil War or not.
Yeah, I think he did. I think he went to Spain.
Yeah, he went to Spain.
Yeah.
So he was on the socialist side in that, but his vision, really, of what the world is becoming proved to be very revolutionary.
What about Aldous Huxley? Did you ever meet him?
Who?
Aldous Huxley, Brave New World author.
Brave New World.
Yeah, the author.
Oh, no, I never met him.
No.
The reason I never met him, He stayed mostly in West Coast around Hollywood, and I was on the East Coast, and so I never met him at all.
Oh yeah. Well, can you
but
tell
he
us
became quite an influential figure.
Yeah, he sure did. Yeah.
Yeah, he knew everybody in Hollywood who was anybody.
Yeah.
Well, I think he was very active in the movie industry itself, and of course, he was a very good writer.
Yeah, he was. So
I used to read his books over and over again.
Well, mentioning books, if people want to get a hold of your books, how do they go about doing it? Because I've noticed that EustaceMullins.com is no longer operating. Why is
no,
that?
I'm setting up a new website right now, and it should be out in the next few weeks.
What will the domain name be?
Well, I don't know exactly yet. Some people are working on it. I haven't got all the details, but it definitely is coming about.
Okay.
So because there's more interest.
If people do a search for your name, then eventually they'll find your new website.
Oh, yes, they'll find it. There's no question about it. Because interest in my work, surprisingly enough, I published the Federal Reserve book in 1953, which is ago, and it's more there's more interest in it now than when I first published it. So the book just goes on by itself. It's never been reviewed.
Yeah, I'll tell you how I found out about you first. I downloaded a video. I think it must have been an early 1990s video, having to do with the Federal Reserve, where you spell out the process you took to discover that what had happened on Jekyll Island.
Oh, yes. Well, that was the greatest crime ever committed in this country, because these conspirators stole the entire money and credit of the American people, and they've had it ever since, a private bank, which is really an amazing thing.
Yeah.
And no one's ever been arrested for it.
Did you?
And the money that they... The money that they, the American people, the only money we have is this money issued by a private bank. Of course, you have the same thing in Bank of England. It's also a bank of issue, and that's a private bank.
Yeah, and it seems to be the model upon which all other central banks are based.
Well, they are, and it was the first one to have its own intelligence service. So the Bank of England has been the in the forerunner of all the modern banking.
Yeah. So, okay, well, thank you very much for spending time with me today. I hope I didn't.
I hope I didn't stop you
from going out and doing your errands.
Oh, I'm really looking forward. Well, I can do that later on. I have plenty of time. It's quite early here. It's only 2 o'clock our time, so I'll be able to get everything done.
Radio Turnspeak.
Thank you for joining us in our quest for the truth. We don't ask you to trust us. In fact, we recommend against it. For more information, go to turnspeak.com or contact us at info@turnspeak.com.